Hi everyone, this is Tim. Welcome to the North and South podcast. This is a well-being podcast and it's a Hope Street podcast. I'm going to be speaking to Ian, who is a volunteer at Hope Street, which is a well-being organisation in Ormskirk in the northwest of England. Me and Ian go along to sessions regularly. So Ian, we're going to have a little chat today about your story, how you got involved with Hope Street, and have a little chat about mental health in men, because men often find it very hard to talk about things and to get in touch with your feelings. So how did you find out about Hope Street and what inspired you to come along?
So I was having a difficult time mentally. This was about 18 months ago. My ex, now ex-partner, she sent me a post, I think it was on Facebook, good old social media, about the peer support sessions. I thought, oh, yeah, I'll go along to that. I messaged Sheila and she, yeah, just come on. So when I got there, she kind of talked to me and introduced me to a couple of people and told me about what the sessions are like. And so, yeah, I'll check it out and stuck with it. And I kind of was consistent with the peer support sessions. And I went to the camp. We started doing the camps last year. I think I went to one of the first ones, I think, in August last year. And that was really good. And that was probably over like a period of time of about, I think it was May to August, I was kind of building up the confidence to kind of talk about what was going on with me. Getting to know people when I was there. But when it came to actually talking about my inner thoughts and the way I'm thinking about stuff, I think it was at the camp in August of 21 that I really started to talk about what was going on in my head and what had been going on with the breakdown of my relationship and therefore becoming a kind of single dad and all that sort of stuff and the guilt around that and stuff and things like that. So Hope Street's been very supportive, given me a lot of tools to use in everyday life to kind of get around some of the issues that I face around, again, being a single dad, managing sort of my own expectations of what to expect from people, whether that's in work or in personal relationships. That's something I struggled with always. And it become more of a struggle over time, especially when, I mean, when you have kids, you have to deal with your own stuff. You have to, otherwise, you know, you kind of, you're letting them down. So yeah, Hope Street was great in that regard and giving me the tool set to really progress. Cause I'd done bits of therapy. I was going through cognitive analytical therapy around about the same time. And to be fair, that was really good. Well, that's really hard to get onto with the NHS. That's really difficult to get. I was very lucky to get that. They do this thing called like the cognitive analytical map, and it kind of maps your behaviors, your triggers, your childhood all the way through to adulthood and how it all interacts with each other. That was really good. And then going to peer support of Hope Street, really, well, I was able to take the theory of what Kat was doing, cognitive analytical therapy, and put it to work in a kind of peer setting, and they could really talk to people about what I was thinking and stuff. So yeah, it was good.
Brilliant. And I've spoken before on the podcast, on other podcasts, about cognitive behavior therapy, CBT, which is a branch of counseling. How would you describe cognitive analytical theory? Is that a little bit more looking at the reasons why rather than just focusing on thoughts and behavior? Is that kind of how CAT is different to CBT?
So yeah, the CAT, cognitive analytical therapy, goes into the whys and the wants and the needs of your sort of cognitive function and what's going on there. So why do I get annoyed about certain things? Why do I become upset around certain things? Why am I getting anxious? And it really delves into like that. Suppose that the traditional thing that you see in films of people lying on the couch, like, tell me about your childhood. It's as close to that I've ever seen from the NHS. And the NHS is really good. For once you're in the system, brilliant, just getting into the system, accessing therapy. Because everyone's entitled to access. You can self-refer to cognitive behavioural therapy through most GPs or even, I think there's Talking Matters in Sefton. Talk Liverpool in Liverpool, and then, but I don't know about Ormskirk. I don't know what their process is. And they're both self-referral as far as I know, which is good, but they only offer very, very limited time frame on what you can actually access. When it comes to something more intensive and more in-depth, you really, really need to get to grips with stuff, then it's a referral process, and that's where your year-long waits come into play and stuff like that, because there's such a long waiting list.
Yeah, I mean, the whole issue with counselling is people thought we're a lot better than we were, say, 20 years ago in terms of being able to discuss mental health and well-being. I think that since 2010, people are more conscious of mental health and well-being, but we've had austerity and all the cuts, etc. And trying to get access through GPs and voluntary services and the National Health Service can be very, very long. And a lot of people go private with these kind of things. And I've discussed this before, where if you go to, say, every 2 weeks, you pay for two sessions a month, which if you're getting paid monthly, makes it a little bit more manageable. But I can't say enough to people listening about the importance of counselling and therapy, I think for everyone. But if you're particularly having a difficult time, it can help you to just take a step back. And sometimes you don't click with the person taking the sessions and you can try different people, but it is very, very worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And I think for men, I think we do need a really good incentive to talk about our emotions. I think we tend to bottle it up inside. And I hope you don't mind me saying, but when you first appeared to host these sessions, you looked like, you know, you had stuff on your mind. And now when you come to the sessions, you look so much more relaxed and content. And I think that you have been on a bit of a journey. I mean, just a bit more on Hope Street. There's lots of different sessions available throughout the week. They do walk and talk. They do choir and singing on a Thursday, LGBTQ groups on a Monday. But for me, I work and going to the peer support on a Tuesday, I find that really helpful. I've been on one of the camping trips like yourself, but there are a number of different things that you can dip into. And it's part of this, what people are now calling social prescription, where if you go to a GP, they might say, join this group. You need to talk to people. You know, you might find things. And is that how you found, you just mentioned that social prescription through Hope Street helped you to come to terms with your emotions. Is that what happened to yourself?
Yeah, I found that it was a combination of things, really. It wasn't all Hope Street. I was doing a lot of reading. I've read Paul Cope's book, How to Solve Any Problem in Life. I've also read Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life book as well. I found them both very helpful in different ways. Paul Cope's book is a lot more practical on a day-to-day basis, whereas Jordan Peterson's book was more of a philosophical view on how to live your life, I suppose. Mm. But yeah, Paul Cope's book was life-changing, to be honest. I went to a talk that he did with Stephen Warnock, who's an ex Liverpool left back, Liverpool FC left back in St. Bede's, and that was brilliant. Just him delivered his talk with Stephen, where he was asking the questions. It was amazing. Yeah, so I've just started Paul Cope's online course, and he uses this method that he developed himself called the Heal and Transform method. It's like combining sort of psychology, clinical psychology, and life coaching, from what he says on the video that he's put through on the online course. Yeah, the online course breaks down the sections of the book into sort of practical exercises that you do. I mean, he has the exercises in the book, but when you're following the online course, it's all the videos and the prompts and stuff. It's obviously a bit easier to do because it's more of like a classroom setting, I suppose. It's always easier to do work in that setting. Yeah, and I also watch a lot of stuff on YouTube around talks on mental health and Jordan Peterson talks and stuff.
Yeah,
he's really good.
Yeah, I mean, I've listened to a lot of Peterson's stuff, and I've read that first book, and I've read Paul Cope's book, and I've done Paul Cope's online course. And I think Jordan Peterson, like him or loathe him for his politics or whatever, does speak at a level which is quite inspirational in terms of you kind of taking control, because he's very influenced by Carl Rogers' approaches to counselling from the 20th century, about an individual saying, right, what's the situation? What can I do to make my life better, kind of thing, regardless of your social context? I think that's very powerful. I think Paul Cope's courses and book is just absolutely phenomenal, as you said, for literally spelling out the kind of things you need to do. And I've spoken to Paul Cope, and I was at the session I hope that he did, and also the Neil Warnock session. And I keep speaking about Paul Cope. I'm going to get him on the podcast soon, but I've never heard anyone speak so commonsensically and also so powerfully about my daily life and the issues that affect me, going right back to your youth, right back to when you're born, and explaining things moving forward. And I think Paul Cope as well, he says that like 50% of what he says is his own and 50% is stuff that he's read, etc., that he's found useful. But he's so coherent and powerful that I think Paul Cope's probably been the biggest single influence on me in terms of coming to terms with things. Even things I've done today, I've dealt with two situations today and I've used what Paul Cope says to deal with them because they've been quite difficult. And I can't speak more highly about those sources that you've referred to. And I think as well as that, Peterson and Paul Cope, I think that they're good for anyone, but there's a particular appeal for men, I think, in terms of the you can deal with this. And also for Paul Cope, the way he says, like, it's okay to have emotions and it's okay to cry and it's okay to be upset as a man. In fact, that makes you more of a man. And that really, really speaks powerfully to me. And how do you feel about those two, about in terms of appealing to like the inner male? And I wouldn't say to anyone listening to this that like women shouldn't read it or whatever, but do you feel like they kind of appeal to you as this inner male, if you know what I mean? Did you get that from those two authors?
Well, it's a strange one, really, because the way men and women approach problems can be so different. You know, the same problem can have different outcomes depending because of the way it's approached. It's like you look at my little lad's just gone to nursery. And I was talking to someone about this. Like the social aspect of kids between boys and girls is like girls are very chatty. No, they're not all this, not 100% of the time, but they tend to be more social quicker, whereas boys tend to be a bit more more of a loner aspect to little kids. And they like to play and make believe in their own little world more, and then I suppose the social aspect comes later. And if you apply that to adults, men will deal with stuff on their own, even if they're in a relationship, because of the fear that they'll be rejected, I suppose, for not being the strong sort of male archetype that unfortunately society over the last 3,000 years has dictated we should be.
Yeah, and that's something I resonate with because we've been talking about relationships. My relationship with my son's mum ended about 13 months ago. It's been very, very difficult. And I think I felt under pressure towards the end of that relationship to be the male provider who goes to work and provides physically and structurally for the family. And I found it really, really hard. That pressure. And I also found it hard not to accept that pressure as if I was expected to be this kind of figure of consistency and almost like above everything, in charge of everything and kind of like expected to do things. And I'm not saying that my partner expected me to do that. And I'm not saying that I expected me to do that. And if you met me, you wouldn't consider me like an alpha male type, but I did feel that pressure to be that person. And I think Peterson kind of taps into that. And Paul Cope, definitely. I mean, he talks about having like the car, the wife, the lovely flat, well-paid job, and yet inside he was really unhappy. And I think that both of them authors did appeal strongly to me in terms of saying, it's okay. It's okay to find that difficult. It's okay to find that difficult. I mean, Peterson almost expects you to still do that. But I find that Paul Cope was saying, no, you don't have to do that. There's another route. Do you know what I mean? It's like Peterson's a conservative and he almost expects like, oh, the male figure should be that kind of figure to a degree. But I found Paul Cope was far more like, no, you don't have to be like that. But I found both of them still very, very useful. And I think being in touch with my emotions, like I left a job last year and I was really upset, crying and that. And loads of people said, oh, well done. It's a real, like, you know, test of being a man that you can let your emotions out. But I still felt like shame over it, you know what I mean? Afterwards, like, oh, I shouldn't really be crying. And I feel like there's an expectation, I don't know, a patriarchal kind of symbol or underpinning symbolism that I'm meant to be this kind of person who can deal with all issues without showing any emotions. And I think that's what a lot of men struggle with, which isn't to say women don't struggle with things, far from it, but it's certainly something that I feel a struggle with.
I think when men show emotion or any form of mental health issue, it's seen as a sign of weakness, and it's handled accordingly, unfortunately. And that's still the way, you know, society goes. It's like, oh, you know, he's showing emotion, you know, oh, his mental health is poor and all that type of stuff. It's like, well, the men should be able to just go about their business, as everyone should be able to go about their business and show emotion, and that's okay. I think the traditional alpha male type is a load of bollocks anyway, because you meet someone who's like a traditional alpha male or whatever, and you have one conversation with them, and there's no substance there a lot of the time. Like they're very kind of one dimensional. Whereas I'd much rather take sort of advice and lead, you know, whoever I'm leading, or I'm working with someone who's an inspirational figure. This can be the case in martial arts a lot of the time. So in the past I've done kung fu, I've done Muay Thai, and obviously I train Brazilian jiu-jitsu now. And I will not listen to a coach who is one-dimensional. I've got no interest in that. If you're one-dimensional as a coach, is in like, I'm a brilliant fighter and that's all you've got about you, I'm not going to train with you. That's, I mean, it helps, don't get me wrong, but you need to have more to you than that. And that's just in a martial arts setting. When you've got managers in work and stuff like that, they have to have more to them than just being able to tell you what to do in a work setting. You've got to have that. There's got to be a dynamic with any sort of relationship, I think. And they've got to be, whether or not it's they realise it's there, but there's got to be an emotional intelligence at play.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't know if you've read The Chimp Paradox or the book about the monkey brain. I forget who wrote it now. I always forget his name. It's a great book, The Chimp Paradox. But when I look at my dad and I look at the more traditional male figure, and I discussed this with Don Byrne from Hope Street as well, and I've just discussed this with other friends of the podcast who've come on, this kind of male, kind of above everything, there in the background, doesn't get emotional. For me, that doesn't satisfy me. And I think it's almost like this new male thing that you with there. I don't want to just be this provider, whatever that means. I also want to like connect emotionally with my family. And I want to have more strings to my bow than that just traditional male figure type that maybe we associate with more, I don't know, working class environments. I'm not sure. I can't really explain it. But I do think that the modern man is expected to be different. And in some ways, there's a tension there. You know, we talk about like the suicide rate among men, and you know the way that young men can turn towards drugs and violence or whatever in certain contexts. I do feel like a lot of that's linked to this kind of inability to find a role in society, kind of thing. And I'm always aware of that pressure in the background, but I certainly don't want to be a one-dimensional person. I think you've captured that right quite well. You know, there are certain people who are very one-dimensional. Here's what I'm supposed to be symbolically, and I'm nothing else. And as you say, when you speak to those people, you can often say, well, I haven't really got much else to say to you. Now, I don't know where you're kind of coming from, but I think it is hard to be more than that. But for me, and I think as Paul Cope kind of alluded to in his work, the true growth is in finding what really makes you happy inside. And to say that there's one model to do that, that obviously isn't going to do it for many people. And I think that you've summarised that well there, this kind of journey that men are on to kind of find a truth about things that isn't just reliant on these, as you say, traditional archetypes. Do you think I've summarised what you were trying to say there?
Probably.
That's a very, very kind and diplomatic way to do it. I think the other thing is with relationships as well. I think, like, you know, the modern male, like particularly with my son, and obviously me and his mum are separated, I kind of want to be there for him at an emotional level. I don't want to just be this like object that's detached as well. So I dropped him off at nursery the other day, and he went in. I could see him sitting at the table having his breakfast, and it was cute. And I was looking at it through the window, and it just really cheered me up. Those little things, which you might not associate with. I couldn't imagine my dad doing that when I was a kid. You know what I'm saying?
No,
I
yeah,
can't imagine
same
his
with
dad doing it. One of the things I've had as well is like, you know, when I've had counseling, we've discussed that kind of traditional role. And I did something called transactional analysis with my counselor, and we discussed the idea of the parent, the adult, and the child. And by that, we're not talking about like you, so an individual's parents or an individual's children or other adults in your life, but the fact that in your mind, it kind of links to Paul Cope's theories in a way that people assume three roles. And there's the parents, which is like either the critical parent or the loving parent. And then you've got the child who's trying to impress the people who look after them or gets upset easily and adopts that kind of poor me mentality. And then you've got the adult in the middle, which is the more balanced and calm person that you want to be most of the time, as it were. And it kind of links into what Paul Cope's theories say about multiple personalities, that you need to be aware of, as Paul Cope says, who is on the mic, who is currently holding the mic in your, as Paul Cope calls it, control deck, because they're the ones in control. And you need to get the adult and the better sub-personalities within yourself on the mic, because if you let the poor me or the critical parent kind of people dominate, that causes problems and unhappiness. When I first became aware of Paul Cope's work, it linked in perfectly with that transactional analysis thing. And they said to me, think about your parents, think about you as a child, and that kind of informed all of that stuff, all of that analysis. And it just came together. I mean, when I first saw Paul Cope, he spoke well, but that online course, which people are hoping to get for free, that's probably the best thing I've ever done, single thing, in terms of really, really getting me to think about how I can make my life better. Because to write a book called How to Solve Any Problem in Your Life, you've got to be good to make a statement like that. And obviously, I can see his influences, but the way he puts it together coherently, I find that a real help in terms of.
I think it's a statement, isn't it? Like how to solve any problem in life. But really, all he's doing, he's not saying this is how you solve your problem in life. He's going, here's a tool. Here's a very, very, very comprehensive toolbox. Go and use it properly, and then you should be able to fix any problem in life. But he isn't talking about things like schizophrenia or bipolar. He's talking about, in my opinion, the circumstantial things. Because when you're going into the realms of clinical mental health issues, he's not, that is a different discussion altogether, in my opinion. I think Paul Cope is brilliant with the circumstantial. I feel dissatisfied, unsatisfied with my life. Same with Jordan Peterson, you know, a lot of lost males, especially in America. And I keep going back to males, but I'm a male, so that's my perspective. I can't talk from a female perspective or the LGBTQ perspective because I'm not that. I talk from my perspective, and that's a depressed male. I have depression, anxiety, and that's just the way it is. You have to deal with it on a daily basis.
I think the other thing with that is that, like, you know, I think that some of my sub personalities might have like a female tendency to them, and part of like what's meant to be the 21st century man is meant to be, you know, moving along this kind of spectrum between the male and the female to a degree. I mean, I'm stating that very, very, very simplistically. And the other thing I think it's important to stress is that saying that you're a male doesn't mean that you dislike people who are different, which I know Peterson is often accused of, quite rightly, by the way, with some of the things he said and argued. But for me, I very much see myself as the troubled male trying to make sense of the world. And up until I was 29, I wouldn't have thought that whatsoever. And then I had this little mental health crisis when I was 29, and I think I've been on a journey ever since trying to understand why that happened and where I'm coming from. And I've gone back into my past. I've had counselling, et cetera. And, you know, I go to places like Hope Street to help with all that. But I
It's
think that
interesting
the.
that you it was 29 when it happened, because you hear a lot of the time that if it's gonna happen, it's gonna happen in your 30s when you start to have a bit of a Maybe not a crisis. You know, they call it a midlife crisis, but is it a midlife crisis, or is the person just having a mental wobble, and they need a bit of support around it? Because whether it's a male or female or whoever, you know, it's very rare that life goes the way you expect it to go. You know, it's like, well, I'm going to be when you're 10 years old, and they ask you in primary school, what do you want to be when you're older? Well, I wanted to be a film director in the week and a train driver at the weekend. I am neither of those things. I mean, I'd love to be a film director, and I'd also love to be a train driver, but it doesn't particularly bother me that I'm not those things. What I'm saying is it doesn't really. And I think it goes back to the parental influence that some people have, of like the expectation that's put on them. Not myself, luckily. My parents were very supportive in whatever it is. Although I'm fairly sure that my dad would have liked me to have gone into the police. I just think that expectation, and this is, and in my job that I've got, I work with people on the spectrum, on the autistic spectrum, neurodivergent, or whatever term you want to use. Asperger's is an older term. And it's all, and in that, there's a lot around their expectation of themselves around relationships and the social interactions that they have, their expectations of their social inclusion and what they expect and hope would happen because they see other people doing things. And I think when you're in your 20s, you're just kind of plodding along. It's like that thing where you go out for a drink in your 20s, you don't have a hangover the next day, but in your 30s, you do have a hangover because we physically, we change, and then mentally we change as well. And you suddenly start to think to yourself, I need to start really kind of getting to grips with stuff here because life's passing me by. Or you have kids, and I'm sure you feel the same, that you have a kid and your entire world just changes completely. And if you're not prepared for that, you can. That's where problems can arise, because if you have never dealt with any underlying mental issues, and then you have a kid, that kid is going to push those mental issues to the fore because you need to deal with them.
Yeah.
It's not the kid who caused you to become unwell. That's not the case. You were unwell anyway. You just have suppressed it for so long. But you need to deal with that. And if you suppress it again and decide, I'm going to walk away or whatever, then that's on you. You know what I mean? If you're not willing to take that step up and take responsibility for yourself.
That's not to say that you can't have really difficult times when you need help.
You need to be able to take responsibility for yourself. And I'm saying that I'm not talking now about people going into crisis, stuff like that. That's a different thing altogether. As like I was talking before about the difference between like self-referral for therapy and being referred by a GP or a psychiatrist to certain types of therapy. That's out of your hands. You know, you've done what you need to do, and then you go into the system. People that go into like a mental health crisis, sometimes you can't be helped. And I'm not talking about taking responsibility for yourself, but if you're not in crisis, but you're aware that you've got issues, oh, you've got an anger problem, for example, and you find, I've got this anger problem. Are you going to talk to anyone about it? Are you doing anything about it? Oh, no. Why? Why aren't you doing anything about it? You've got to take responsibility for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I often find that, you know, you get a lot of people, when it gets tough, they can turn to coping mechanisms and addictions, which are unhealthy. And again, I think Paul Cope covers everything that you just said in terms of processing emotions, getting things out in the open. Jordan Peterson mentions a good thing. He calls it like a dragon. He said, it's like sometimes if there's a dragon in the house, or you can call it an elephant in the room, where people, there's issues between a couple, or there's issues with you. And it's like you don't acknowledge the elephant in the room, or the dragon, as Peterson calls it. And it's about saying, right, here's an issue here. Am I going to deal with this issue, or am I going to let it get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger? And that's where communication, just very quickly, that's where communication is important, which can be hard, but also communicating with yourself, being able to, as we were talking about earlier, maybe having an emotional journal where you can process your emotions, go through your emotions, which I've spoken about before, because if you don't do that, these things can get out of hand. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, as you said, to get out of hand, like if there's a big, an elephant or a dragon in the room that you're not dealing with, something's going to come along that's going to spook that dragon, and it's going to bite you on the ass. That's just the way it is.
As you say, these things get bigger, and you need to go, okay, there's an issue here that needs to be addressed. And sometimes acknowledging the issue in the first instance can be really big. I mean, I've had things going on in my life, and then like someone says something, you go, oh my God, like I just haven't seen that. It's hidden in plain sight, you know. And sometimes you need a little bit of help or assistance. But if you're not on top of things, like, I mean, we all know, like, you know, if you have a bad day, again, it's hard to find time to do things like reflect or have a reflective journal or an emotional journal or a gratitude journal. It is hard. But for me, I know that if I don't do them, my life's worse. So therefore, I need to do them. I know that that's a fact. That is as close to a fact as it's going to get. So the days when I don't do them, I know that I'm making my life worse. And I'm aware of that, but some days I still don't do it because of, you know, I wouldn't say crisis, but you just don't get a minute to yourself or whatever. But I do that, and I know I'm better when I do it. And if an issue comes up, I'll say, right, there's an issue here that needs to be addressed. For me, that's important. If you can get to that stage, identifying the issue, that's important. Because like I've gone to counsel and said, right, I'm not happy with A, B, C, D, E about me. And I think that's so powerful to be able to say, I need to work on me. I know I need to work on me. And I'm also in need of some help to work on me. And that can come in a number of different ways. But to do that rather than turn to the bottle or to walk away from a child or to destroy a relationship, in many ways, it just makes sense. Even though it's hard to do it, you've got to acknowledge those issues. You've got to want to better yourself. And I'm not saying it's easy, but down the other route is just madness. And I think that responsibility, being in touch with reality and being able to acknowledge those elephants and dragons and saying, right, this needs to change, that's the first step, being able to acknowledge it.
I unfortunately, like, because I hadn't dealt with stuff that was kind of going on with me, and then I got my son's mum, like our relationship broke down because I hadn't dealt with those things, and then I started to deal with them, but obviously things happen and it gets too late. But because I've actively took responsibility for myself and tried to improve my situation, okay, it's never going to be 100% at a time. It's, you know, it's going to be like little 0.5%, 1% at a time, but you gradually, you take those steps, you know. I've got a really kind of, I'm in a good situation logistically for living, and it means I've got a really good situation for having Alex over and stuff like that, my little boy. I'm in a really good position to be as good a father as I can be for him. And emotional intelligence as well, you know, having that there and being aware of what I'm doing as a father. And as you said before, like the where is me sort of parental aspect, the kids and the adult, like, you know, if it's a choice between like the parent or the adult in the room, you know, without, I will be the adult in the room, and I'll make sure that my emotions are in check and that they are appropriate and positive for Alex at all times.
Yeah, I think that's wisdom, isn't it? And I think that when my relationship ended, there were a lot of things I needed to go right. I need to step up and I need to accept responsibility for what I've done wrong. I need to go and see a counsellor. The things I've learned over the last 13 months, like the ADHD kind of thing in me, which I'm exploring at the moment, it's been so powerful. And I think what you just said there, people think I'm not changing because the other person won't change, but you've got to change even if they don't. And, you know, a lot of people say, oh, they're not changing, they're not doing. People don't. But you need to change yourself for the best. And if the other person doesn't change, then, you know, you either try and work on it, or ultimately maybe it's better if they have a minimal role in your life or no part in your life. And again, that's wisdom, because ultimately you need to be the best person for yourself and also for Alex and, in my case, Michael. If you're not the best version of yourself for whatever reason, then you need to work on the things that are stopping that. And I think that's wisdom, isn't it? It's just wisdom, because you can't say to people, oh, you need to change, you need to do this. They've got, so people have said things to me in the past and I've gone, that's helpful, that's useful, that. Some people, anything that's perceived as criticism, they just double down. And I just think that shows such a lack of self-esteem when any modicum of criticism that comes your way in terms of your emotions or your family or whatever, that you just double down. That is such a low self-esteem position to be in.
That's something I've struggled with, like criticism in the past. Somebody will say, "Oh, you're doing this," or "You just stop doing that," and then that's caused an argument in the past because I've just been unable to hear it through whatever reason. Maybe it's something from childhood or aces, I suppose, if you want to call it that. But and I do struggle with criticism. But then I think everyone does. Everyone struggles with criticism.
Yeah,
it's a human thing.
To varying degrees as well. I think ADHD, people with ADHD that I may well be, it's actually acknowledged that they find criticism quite hard. And for me, I've often had criticism. Obviously, people criticise you non-constructively at times, where that's like an arrow through the heart kind of thing. You know, it's a similar kind of feeling. But you can say to people, like, that wasn't constructive criticism. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're then going to be constructive next time. And I mean, today, someone said something today which on a bad day would have really, really, really upset me and got to me. But today, because I'm kind of being mindful, and ultimately the solution to all this is to be mindful in any situation and just take a step back and relax and be stoic and deal with it. And if necessary, apply what I call the 24-48-hour rule. Don't respond now, get calm, and then think of your response kind of thing. But someone said something today which was cruel and horrible to me. Someone fairly close to me, and not the people I live with or anything like that. And I thought to myself, that is such a horrible thing to say. What does that say about them? But also, what does that say about me today that I've been able to just take that, you know, without responding and without getting upset? I mean, maybe it might come back to me later, I don't know, but not to respond, to be stoic, to be equanimous, to just stay relaxed in a crisis, that is such a powerful thing. I mean, think about people who, when there's a crisis, you seem to stay calm. They almost seem like godly, don't they? You go, wow, what a person to have around in a crisis. You know, the people get attracted to them kind of people, and those people end up being leaders. Just very quickly, your job is working with neurodivergent people to support them. It's like your current position. How does that work?
I'm a support time recovery worker for people on the autistic spectrum. Cool. So I support them to access health and well-being and social inclusion and stuff like that.
Excellent. And do you find martial arts helps you with the kind of mental balance that you see? Did you find that useful?
So I haven't really trained over the last couple of weeks because of various... I started a new job last week, which is... impacted that, and the change over the last few months about when I see Alex has massively affected how often I can train. But I was training like twice a week, which is, you know, with what the amount of stuff that's going on, is pretty good. So yeah, I find it's really, it's a good balance that, because it's two things really. It's a great expel of energy. It's really good. It's a very, very hard martial. I train Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Been training for 11 years now. I had a gap over COVID, and then a few months ago I had a gap of about 2 months. But with COVID, I think I stopped training in the March of 2020, and I didn't go back till... So yeah, it was about a year of stopped training for about a year. Put weight on and all that crap, so I need to think about shifting it. But I find it massively helpful. It's social. It makes you think. It's like human chess. So you know, you're not just running around in a circle, you're not just running around the track, which I'm sure is great. People enjoy that, really.
Yeah, and you know Kevin Mack, who's been on the podcast as well, he does Brazilian Jiu Jitsu. You've worked with him before, haven't you?
I've known Kev for about 7 or 8 years now. He recently got his black belt, actually. So, but Kev's great. Kev's a great guy. John Smith, who he owns ASW Liverpool, they own it together. John Smith's great as well. He'd be a good person for your podcast, actually. He does this thing called The Hostile Operator.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really good stuff.
I follow him on Instagram, and Kev did mention that, actually, about getting him on. Yeah, and I am going to get him on in the future because, again, I think he'd be a good
John
character.
And Kev over in ASW Liverpool are brilliant. So anyone in that area, they're in Skem.
Yeah, yeah, that's where they're based. Yeah, yeah. You and Kevin on my list of people not to get into fights with, mate. So unless you start teaching me, is it grappling and Brazilian jiu-jitsu? I might be able to compete, but I don't think that's going to happen.
And this guy called Chris Thompson, who is based over in Spain, who used to be my coach. I've trained with a few people, Ross Hudson as well. I trained with him when I lived in Ormskirk a few years ago. I was training with Ross for a few years. I started with Ross. He's now in the police. I don't think he doesn't teach anymore. He's in the police. And now I train with a guy called Kev Corkill, who's took over the gym from Chris when it was in Liverland. Gets very complicated. Yeah, it's full of politics and creonteism. I'm sure people in jiu-jitsu will know what that means. But yeah, I just enjoy it. I'm a hobbyist. I've got no I'm at peace with the fact that I'm probably, if I do compete again, it's only ever going to be locally. I just enjoy training when I can train. So, but as Kev Corkle once said, you know, you get to purple belt, brown belt, you know, you've been training that long, the entire life events have happened. So it is okay to sometimes have gaps in your training, because I'm not a full-time athlete. I've got a job. I've got a little boy that I see as often as I can. So, but yeah, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is amazing and I highly recommend it to anyone.
Good stuff. I'd love to do it. Love to do it. I've heard before other people say that it's the ultimate form of self. Like, if anyone comes at you in any way, apart from if they fire a bazooka at you from like 20 meters away, that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is the ultimate form of self-defense and being able to turn the situation to your favor against any.
I honestly believe that all police, without exception, should at least, when they join the police, and I'm sure many police who train Jiu-Jitsu would agree, that when you join the police, part of the training should be Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, because it's how to control someone properly, you know, safely on the ground and all of that.
Without kneeling on the neck or
doing whatever. Yeah. Like, a lot of this police brutality stuff in this country, America, potentially could be avoided if they knew how to grapple.
Sam Harris, I don't know if you know Sam Harris, who does Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He's done podcasts on it. He's like a neuroscientist and like public intellectual. He's actually, Jordan Peterson said he's the toughest person to debate with. Like, you can watch them on YouTube. But Sam Harris is brilliant. His podcasts are brilliant. And his app, Waking Up, which is a mindfulness app and meditation app. He had a podcast saying all police officers in the United States should do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And if everyone did it, it doesn't matter who you are. You can hold your own against anyone. And
I know for a fact that Ross, who I mentioned before, who was in Ormskirk, he's a brown belt Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He's in the police. I know for a fact that he is doing training with the police. I don't know, I'm not going to say or even hazard to guess where he is in the police, you know, what area, but, and I know for a few other people I've trained with over the years, who I do train with at the moment, are police, and they're very good grapplers. They use it all the time. So
yeah, it's good to watch as well, like people listening. I mentioned this with Kev Mach, but like watch on YouTube a few videos of grappling and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And you can appreciate the art of it and also the utility of it. You know, it's very, very good. But I think the mental balance as well from the... I'm one of the biggest things I talk about on... I've done it on other podcasts, is like, you know, that morning routine about like getting up and exercise. Like I went for yoga this morning and getting up, exercising. Make exercise and a good start to the day your friends rather than your enemy. Talk about elephants in the room. I'll still have days when I get up and I go, oh, bit grumpy or not doing it today, and I'm never as efficient or effective on those days. So finding that hobby, that thing, that passion that like keeps you fit, keeps you producing positive endorphins, etc.
Yeah,
you know, it's so useful.
I mean, part of my morning routine, I get up whatever time I get up, usually about 7:30. I'm not a morning person in any way whatsoever, but I get up around about 7:30, have a pint of water, a cup of coffee. I don't have any breakfast, but I have a cold shower, and the cold shower is massive. Like, it's a big help because it doesn't really matter. Oh, I also have a SAD lamp, a seasonal affective disorder lamp, which is really good. because it replaces the spectrum of light you lose in the winter, and it does help when you wake up and you feel a bit like a zombie. You put the light on, it kind of helps a little bit, you know, you feel a bit better, a bit more alive, and then you go and get a cold shower. Someone I know said a cold shower is like a motivational drowning.
I do both of those things, sad lamps and cold showers. I got into it through the Wim Hof thing, and then it's become a bit more wide known because, I mean, people have said that to me in the past, and I've said no chance. When I started, I just did it onto my chest, but now, like, I start with it on the back of my head, and it's a real shock. Doesn't bother me now. Like, I'm in there for 2 minutes in the morning. When you get out, you feel energized, and you've got like a warmth through you. It's hard to explain, but
Oh, yeah.
every time I'm in the shower now, I have a normal shower, hot shower, and then cold, turn around, and it goes onto me like the back of my head and goes down, and it's very, very stimulating, one might say. But if you're going to start doing it, it's probably better to just do it onto your chest or your legs just to get used to that initial shock, and then you can put other parts under. But I find it so useful, and it really wakes you up in the morning and makes you feel more positive.
A cold shower, similar to sparring and Brazilian jiu-jitsu, is your problems that you're facing in life or your anxieties or whatever, pale in comparison to the freezing cold water hitting your body and the shock that you go into, and the fact that when you're on the mat with someone in jiu-jitsu, they're trying to rip your arm off. All your problems in life sort of pale in comparison to those two situations that you find yourself in. So they're very good for kind of leveling your mind out a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure talking about your journey to Hope Street, mental health among men. We talked about Paul Cope, Jordan Peterson,
Yeah, I think I
relationships.
may have.
Also, you've mentioned your job, importance of martial arts, and like a good start to the day and stuff. So we've covered lots there. But thanks very much for coming on, giving up your precious time on a Sunday. Me and Ian met through Hope Street. Details for Hope Street are in the notes. Get involved. Also, if you want to come on this podcast to discuss mental health, well-being, creativity, politics, history, feel free. If you want to contribute financially for the price of a cup of coffee once a month, details are in the notes at coffee.com. Please like, share, subscribe on YouTube and Spotify. Spread the word. Ian, thank you very much for your time, mate.